Welcome. I'm Steve Hadley, Chair of the Federation of Pioneering Specialists. Our guest on the inaugural FPS podcast is one of the rock stars of geotechnics in the last 20 years. He's authored the ICE Manual of Geotechnical Engineering, the ICE Specification for Pioneering and Embedded Retaining Walls. He's an advocate for sustainability before it is even fashionable. He's a director at ARUP, reached the top in geotechnics, then had a change in direction. We're talking about his journey, sustainability, major project procurement. Thank you also to our sponsors, Casa Grande UK. Let's hear a message from them.
Casa Grande UK has been one of the leading suppliers of piling and drilling equipment to the UK and Irish foundation markets for over 30 years. We are the exclusive dealer for the UK and Ireland for a number of globally renowned manufacturers of this type of equipment, including Casa Grande, Hutti, Eurodrill, HD Engineering, PTC and STA. We can supply and service a huge range of equipment, including large diameter rotary and CFA piling rigs, small diameter drilling and mini piling rigs, diaphragm walling equipment, rotary and percussive heads, as well as vibro piling and grouting equipment. Please contact us by email at info@casagrandeuk.com or by phone 01296 651 043. That's 01296 651 043.
Just like to welcome my guest on the first FPS podcast, Tim Chapman. How are you?
Hi, Steve. I'm very well. It's interesting times we're living in at the moment. And I could say we just need to count our blessings, I think, at the moment. Difficult times for an awful lot of people, but actually really interesting times and seeing a lot of things hopefully getting better, looking out at a beautiful day with clear skies and clear air over London.
I can see that you are working remotely. So how are you adjusting personally to that situation?
Well, generally very well. I mean, but again, I think it's a time when we have to be really thankful about for the blessings that we have. I mean, I've got a nice house, I've got a garden, and I feel really, really, really sorry for those people who are sort of stuck inside with three small children in a tiny flat and no balcony. So in a way, it's a time for counting blessings and also in a way adapting to the new ways of doing things. I mean, who would have thought that we'd be able to do this in the way that we are? I mean, I've been on two meetings already this morning so far, and they've probably gone quicker and more effectively than they would have gone if we'd done them traditionally. People are actually on time for meetings, which is very unusual. People are never more than 2 minutes late in this new world. It shows many ways we can do things better, I think.
I absolutely agree. I think there's a lot that we can learn and take from this experience, and I hope that that they're not forgotten, those lessons, once we come out of it, which there are some positive signs now in terms of the numbers with the virus. It has been a really tough period, and it's been important that the construction industry has kept working through it. And thank you to everybody working in the construction industry that might be listening to this, that you are going out there and working and taking those steps to stay safe. Like to talk a little bit about your journey, Tim. You've been one of the highest profile geotechnical engineers in the UK for a few decades. your journey has changed somewhat, and we'll touch on that as well. But I wondered if we can start by really exploring how you came to join the geotechnical industry and just some of your highlights in your career development.
When I was in sort of school and then university, the number of things interested me. So I was interested in law. I was interested in journalism. I was interested in planning. And actually, when I went to university, I wanted to become a planner, but I got seduced by the fun of playing with soil when I was in university. I didn't know it was a proper job until I thought it was only a thing I played with as a small kid until I actually discovered it was a proper serious career. And I've really enjoyed geotechnics as a basis. And I think it gives people a really good basis for many different professions, because geotechnical engineers learn to deal with uncertainty. Part of it is obviously a science. We do sums, we design piles, we design retaining walls, and those need to be done as economically as possible. And therefore, we do calculations to make sure that they work. But actually, there's a huge art behind it. And the art is about actually managing uncertainty. And actually, in these sad times, managing uncertainty is a skill that every chief executive of every major corporation needs in spades. And we, as geotechnical engineers, are superbly equipped to do that. I was in a conversation yesterday where somebody was musing about the fact that the people at the top of most large organisations, there's usually a high preponderance of geotechnical engineers amongst them. And I think that's, again, just because of the art of managing uncertainty and ambiguity, actually, initially in the ground. But when we start dealing with people issues, as you do, as you get more senior in the industry, they're equally ambiguous and uncertain. And so it gets quite interesting.
Yeah, it's certainly been a big challenge, and we have to react extremely quickly. And the industry, I think, has shown it to be one that can adapt. So you did a degree in civil engineering, then moved into a specialisation in geotechnics, is that?
Yeah, so first degree was in civil engineering from University College Dublin. I then had a chance to do a master's in imperial and soil mechanics, which I took. And then I joined Arup Geotechnics, where I've been for almost a third of a century now. And probably the advantage of my time in Arup has been I've had a chance to sort of develop a career. The first probably two decades were largely geotechnical. So I learned my trade sort of in ways that people probably wouldn't understand now, sitting here in front of lots of technology. But when I first started working, the only electronic device I had was a calculator. Computers were only used for analysis and were shared amongst 10 or 15 people. And mobile phones were a glint in somebody's eye that had yet to come along for good or for bad. I shared a telephone extension with three other people. At one stage, confusingly, two of them also called Tim, which led to an initial sort of first while on phone calls taking a little while. And then gradually, obviously, technology kicked in. Interestingly, actually, comparing our grads now, I don't think their job's very different to mine, and I don't think they're more productive than I was back a third of a century ago. I think lots of things have actually come over. So while there's efficiencies from computers and from very fast communication, and again, I mean, when I kicked in, the fax machine was a novelty. But looking at our grads nowadays, and looking just actually at their productivity, and I'm not saying this as a specific Arab thing, it's an industry thing, I do find it really quite shocking the productivity hasn't increased. And I think probably it's worthwhile, Steve, us maybe musing later on about the extra amount of extra process that's come into what we do and how much that extra process is worthwhile and how much of it isn't. And I do think there's an awful lot we could do to streamline the industry and actually use the new technology to be an awful lot more productive in how we communicate. And again, this is not a geotechnical thing. This is imposed on us by wider project processes. And like I say, some of them are really good. I mean, sorry, first of all, you spoke when we first started about safety, and safety is absolutely, it's transformed over my career, and that I salute and applaud. We engage with society better, but not as good as it should be, and not proportionately, I think, to the amount of money that gets spent on it. And I think an awful lot of the process that we have now in terms of engagement tends to be more of a way of making sure we've done the right thing rather than proper engagement. I think there's different types of process, but like I say, not all of it good.
No, it can be overwhelming sometimes, just sheer amount of emails. You know, I'll go out for a run at lunchtime and I'll come back and there is literally 50 emails. Now I've got team messages as well that are coming through, which actually I find slightly easier to deal with because I can sort of ignore most of those, be a voyeur on the conversation, if you will, whereas the emails I feel more obliged to actually put in a reply. But I think we do need to be careful in terms of our communication that we're not overloading our colleagues, and as you say, that can become inefficient. Whilst we're talking about efficiencies and sustainability, I'm really interested in your time that you spent on the reuse of foundations for urban sites, RUFUS, more commonly referred to as. Can you talk to us a little bit about your knowledge of that document? Because it's not been as prominent in recent years, but there's clearly a lesson there to be learned and relearned. We've got young engineers probably listening to this podcast that maybe not even aware of that document. And I think it's sometimes important to go back and bring out these documents and see what we can take from it.
It was actually fun doing it. The whole RUFUS project, RUFUS was an EU research project, and there's also a parallel Syria report on it for our UK listeners, which is slightly more accessible. It's on sort of the Syria backlist for those of you who look at such things. It came out of a project I did in the City of London where we had no option but to reuse a set of piles. But we discovered, again, there was huge impediments against that, lots and lots of inertia. And the critical thing in those days was the district surveyor had a complete ban on any form of foundation reuse, because once a foundation had been used, the belief was it was so uncertain and so damaged you could never go back and use it again. And actually, taking it to its extreme, you had to consider it as worse than ordinary ground. So you had this big lump of concrete which had served a function for 20, 40, 50, 100 years, and suddenly it became not just a waste product, but a waste product in a very, very expensive location. The critical thing we discovered was that with London sites probably being at that stage being refurbished every 30 years, within a century, there's going to be no more foundations in London, and therefore no more new buildings in London, because we're just using all the available space. So what started off as a necessary on one site where it had been built just after World War II, and there was a series of big level changes around it, which meant that we couldn't safely get in to put new foundations in, and therefore it was the best way out of a complicated situation. Then developed into basically dealing with a form of urban pollution where our cities were going to run out of room. There was going to be no space for new foundations, and therefore, and even on the second or third set of foundations, we've all done sites which are very, very full. But when we take that through to the fourth or fifth set, it was going to be absolutely impossible. So that realisation got a lot of people very interested, and I was fortunate enough to lead that initially on a UK level and then on a European level to make sure that we could work better. And with a series of partners, both university and industrial partners, we did a lot of really good work, I think, to make sure that that problem went away. And you're right, Steve, it is a minority interest one. I wouldn't advocate on a new site. Obviously, on a new site, you have to put new foundations in. But on a first-generation site, often it's easy to put new foundations in because there's lots of space available for them. And to some extent, it comes almost back down to circular economy principles, that if you're putting something in, you make sure they should last for a very long time. And the critical thing came down to keeping good records to make sure that people in future years, sort of 30, 40, 50 years hence, could come along and reuse foundations much more easily and much more economically and get much more load out of them. I mean, we know we can effectively use an old foundation if we put half the load on. But the critical thing is actually almost increasing the load with time was, I think, the nirvana that we were seeking at the time. But mainly it was a really... Go on.
Sorry, Tim, it's quite unusual for buildings that are replacing an old one to be smaller. So the new building will probably be another 10 stories high in the City of London, maybe even more. So you've got this balance where you're trying to put in a cost efficient, sustainable foundation solution, but actually it may be worth in the long term for financial reasons and environmental reasons to put in larger piles or put in more piles, which must be quite a difficult balance to strike. And where did you end up with that?
No, you're right. There's many interesting aspects of it. I mean, again, when we started the work, some people in the piling industry viewed me as deeply evil and thought I was going to do away with the future of piling. And I tried reassuring them at the time that wasn't the aim, that we were only trying to do effectively the right thing and look out for the future. And some people probably never quite forgave me for that. But I think in hindsight, we didn't do away with the future of the piling industry. I'd like to think actually we made the piling industry. Yeah, no, still here, still working hard, still pouring concrete into the ground, and will be for many years to come in a good way. But the critical thing is doing the right thing for the future. So in a way, it foreshadowed some of the things that we're doing now with carbon and other aspects that we need to keep on thinking about very hard, I think. And the critical thing always is to do the right thing. Try and do circular economy principles, try and do the best you can. And by doing so, you're just making the future of the industry cleverer, not dumber. But sustainability always must be a good thing. But the initial phase of sustainability does take a level of bravery, because in the initial phases, people don't necessarily see the full possibilities.
With Rufus, as you say, in the mid-2000s, possibly there wasn't the appetite there at the time. The world seems to have shifted, and there was a real gaining of momentum over the last couple of years around environmental sustainability. And just in terms of our own personal choices, I go and buy a new shirt. I'm not just looking at the way it looks, but the way it's made, materials used, how far it's travelled to get to me. I'm looking at the supply chain. There's all sorts of things. Yes, it might cost more than an alternative that looks just as good. But me as a consumer, I'm making decisions based on environmental factors. And I think we'll start to see that more from clients in building and construction. And that will extend all the way down the supply chain to people procuring piles as well. The FPS of a number of years ago, in conjunction with the European Federation of Foundation Contractors, have launched a carbon calculator, and it's something that we're very keen to push amongst our membership. I think at the time there probably wasn't the appetite, but I think we will see a shift now with some renewed emphasis. I think that's going to be a really powerful tool. Tim, you've been involved also with some low carbon techniques and products as well. Is that right?
Yeah, I was going to say, Steve, in your introduction, you've actually touched on many, many aspects of this. So can I just pick up three of those initially? The first one, I think, is you picked up a point of actually how you invest in carbon. And as a country, we invest largely on what's called cost-benefit ratios, which are to do with money initially. And they seem very sensible and seem very prudent. And it goes back to your shirt analogy of actually, in a way, buying for at least cost, the most effective one. And unfortunately, the country hasn't yet reached your sophistication in shirt buying. So there's a thing called the Green Book, which is published by the Treasury, which is how we invest in major infrastructure projects. And it largely goes on money terms. They've added in social value as an extra term. But the hope is that people still actually turn carbon into money, and it's all done in money terms. But the critical thing is that you can't turn carbon into money. Yes, you can put a price on tons per carbon, a price of tons of CO2 emissions and things like that. And it's about 20 quid at the moment. But actually, that misjudges the calculation. There's a lovely cartoon I saw a little while ago of two people in ragged clothes, middle of a desert, staring at sort of a wilderness of sort of demolished buildings and everything else. One of them says to the other, "And for a brief moment in time, there was a huge amount of shareholder value created. We're going into a world where basically climate change could destroy everything, and it doesn't actually matter how good a cost-benefit ratio is, and they're only a moment in time anyway." So I think, first of all, investing wisely is a really important point. Secondly, and the FPS carbon calculator is an aspect of this. The critical thing is making sure that we reduce whole life carbon. And part of that is the embodied or capital carbon that goes into the product. And part of it is actually how it's then used afterwards. And I'm really anxious that we don't, in a way, concentrate on capital carbon to the exclusion of all else, because the critical thing is actually what the whole product does and its impact on society. So as an example, we could do some really, really efficient piles for something deeply evil or something deeply wrong. And that clearly is the wrong way to go. So I'd actually ask everybody in the industry to actually think about the right thing. There's a standard called PAS 2080, and the FPS carbon calculator fits into it. And it separates out every project into three components: the capital carbon, which we know what it is, the embodied carbon, the operational carbon, so it uses the analogy of CapEx and OpEx, the operational carbon to actually run the thing. And third is the user carbon, the sort of the fact that society will use the product. So Highways England will build a new motorway, capital carbon. They'll run the motorway, so traffic officers drive up and down and they light it, which is operational carbon. But actually on a new road, the huge amount of carbon is on the people driving along it. And that dwarfs all the other ones. So doing the right project in the right way is really important. And the three components really matter. But as geotechnical engineers, we often only have visibility on the capital carbon, which is important in its own right, but I don't want to overdo it. And the third point, again, Steve, which you touched on, I think, in your really erudite introduction, is actually what we should do in various ways. And I think the things that we should do as an industry, and I think that's really important, so we all need to come together. I think this podcast is a really good way of trying to make sure we spread that word. There's what happens in individual firms, and we all should make sure that our firms are doing the right thing. There's what we do as individual professionals in our professional life to try and reduce carbon, and I think that's really important. And then finally, it's what we do as consumers. And again, your shirt buying is an important part, and you have got actually control in a way of all four parts of the jigsaw at the moment, Steve, in your role. So as an individual, you're buying the right shirt. as a professional in your day-to-day working, you're doing the right thing. At the moment, you're controlling a fair chunk of the industry in terms of actually what we do and what the FPS is doing. And then it's actually, I'd say, the pan thing of what we do across the wider industry.
Well, thank you. It puts a lot of onus on my shirt, so I'm sure people will be keeping a close eye on that in the next few months and years. Yeah, I think you've summed it up really well there, Tim. It's interesting that you've now got such a broad knowledge of these issues, presumably from your move into infrastructure. Can you just explain, because there'll be lots of people that are familiar with you from your work in geotechnics, and you've reached the top. Why did you choose to have such a career shift into that field?
Sorry, the question's an interesting one, and I probably shouldn't confess this, but I mean, part of it was the worry that when my boss, who ran our infrastructure group in London, went on to do something else, it was what my group of geotechnical and tunnelling engineers would do if our boss wasn't as good as the previous one was. We're in the middle of the recession from sort of 2008, 2013-14, and I realised in a way I needed to sort of step up to make sure that what I'd done and created and protected could do better. As you say, it was a really big step to go into a different world. But fortunately for me, it wasn't actually a huge step, because geotechnics and tunnelling remained part of what I did personally, and it remained a large part of what the group did. So about a quarter of the group I took over remained doing geotechnics and tunnelling. But the group also did maritime work, big bridges, rail, road, energy projects. And it gave me an interesting perspective because, again, as a geotechnical engineer, there's only so much you can affect on a project. You basically wait for someone to want piles. Some of us design them, some of us build them, and then we go away again and we don't really see the whole picture. Leading a big infrastructure group gave me a very bigger and broader perspective on the whole industry, going right from sort of project creation at the very early phase, why someone builds a metro, why you might want a new underground line, why you might want a big building in the very first place, the chance to engage with those clients and understand what they're trying to achieve, and then follow the whole process through, and also to see what the outcome is at the end of the day. And again, the fun bit about infrastructure is the outcome is always for society. So society benefits by what we do. So if you're building a new road or a new railway line or a new water treatment plant, at the end of the day, it's actually us as consumers in a very equitable way, hopefully receive the benefits of that. And that brought me onto a lot of the sort of the important side of what we do as an industry and the outcomes that we create. And also, there's different ways of creating outcomes. Again, as someone who is originally a civil engineer, I do have a penchant for things that are made of concrete and steel and dirt. And we all get a kick out of doing those. But sometimes the outcome can be done using technology. So, for instance, we might initially say, let's build a new viaduct and a railway line and create a new railway line, a new physical asset to enable us to double capacity. We can do the same thing by maybe doubling the capacity by improving the signalling system on the line, or by doubling the length of the rolling stock that use the line if we actually upgrade the stations as well. So there's many different ways of achieving the same outcome, not just necessarily playing with concrete and steel. And that probably brought me back to the same level of revelation that we had with the Rufus thing that you brought up earlier, Steve, where it's not necessarily always the best thing just to pour more concrete and steel. And other solutions might be better for the environment and for society. They might be cheaper. We might enable the people to be transported much more easily. We might be able to arrange for hospitals to treat more people more cheaply, more economically, so we can have more treatment at the end of the day. So it's the actual social side of what we do that really, really matters. And I think to some extent, we forget that when we're just designing or building piles. We forget that we're part of a much bigger thing. And actually, we forget the fact that most of what we do is for public good. And therefore, it's not just the fact we work for a company. I think we largely serve society and we make society better.
Well, that's very profound. I think most of us as young engineers contemplating joining the industry, that's really what motivates us to get involved in civil engineering, is thinking that we can make a difference. And clearly the sort of steps that you've made have enabled you to do that. Like to, you mentioned the Green Book. You're also involved in the Project 13. I don't know if it's directly in that particular project, but you've certainly got an overview of that. And this is, I must admit, a pretty new topic for me. think I'd not even heard the term Project 13 till about 6 months ago when I had a meeting with Heathrow Airport. But since been doing a little bit of reading up, but I know that you'll be able to share a little bit of your experience with the listeners.
Thanks, Steve. I mean, we keep on reinventing the industry, and we keep on never quite getting there. So again, I spoke earlier on about my own experience and productivity at an individual level, and actually I do lament the fact that we haven't made it better. And Project 13 is an effort to try and do that at an industry level, but in the same way that the Egan and Latham reports did in times gone by. So there's been a whole series of industry initiatives trying to make things better. And yes, we don't necessarily seem to get better enough at any stage. Maybe without these initiatives, we'd actually be getting worse and worse and worse. So maybe they're protecting us from utter calamity. And I think there's some interesting overlays on the industry at the moment. I mean, digital is one. And yes, we're moving in. So again, good piling firms like yours are doing digital records. There's lots of things happening in a good way, but we're not getting the efficiency out of them. We all invested heavily in BIM in 2016 when the government mandated it. We all became really, really BIM ready, but the industry somehow didn't quite get to use BIM in the advanced way for many of the ways it should have been done. And Project 13, I think, is part of that. It's looked at the softer side of things and trying to sort of say, well, actually, the client wants an outcome, as I was explaining before and sort of the examples I was giving. And therefore, how can he or she engage the value chain to make sure that we do the right thing? A lot of it sort of sprang from work that Anglian Water had done, where they had done some really good things actually on carbon. And they came together with a number of other client bodies to try and actually sort of pool best expertise for how to do these things well. So I think Project 13's got a huge amount of elements that are really good. I also observe probably it's not working out quite as well as people would have liked it to have worked out. I think the procurement phase is one where I think it's got some work yet to be done. And I've highlighted my concerns about that to the people who are running Project 13, the infrastructure client group, and the Institution of Civil Engineers, who are sort of provide the clienting and the secretariat behind it. But I think in a way, to some extent, Project 13 has also been sometimes treated a bit like a religion, where it's actually all or nothing. And I think actually it'd be much better to be probably more flexible and to adopt lots of the elements of Project 13, which are brilliant. I mean, the whole focus on outcomes, I think, is revolutionary. I think it brings us into aspects that we can bring digital into. It can bring in elements of build off-site and recognize that these things need to have a common core amongst them so that we can actually do them well. So again, productization of construction, I think, is a large part of it. Not build off site per se, but make sure that we effectively industrialize the processes. And again, Project 13 asked a lot of the right questions to make sure those things happen.
Well, it sounds like it should help move the industry forward. It's been built up around infrastructure, large-scale infrastructure projects. But all the principles that you're talking about there, they could equally apply to a small-scale construction project as well, couldn't they? Putting value on long-term relationships and sustainability in the supply chain, efficiencies. There's no reason that type of thing can't happen at a smaller level.
I think it's actually more applicable at a smaller level, because again, at the macro level, I mean, we're not going to build a HS2 every year or every decade or even every professional lifetime. So HS2 by its very nature is going to be a one-off prototype. But on the smaller projects you talk about, Steve, yes, hugely, there's huge opportunities to be much more innovative. And the cycle is so short in smaller projects, we actually can innovate much more quickly. So I think actually we can have more fun doing those things. Again, on a smaller project, the team is smaller. The client can trust people better. And that client actually, in a way, doesn't go by and actually buy a different supply chain every time and trust the supply chain that they have. But say, I want you to drive down price. I want you to drive down carbon. I want a better outcome for the people who are going to use this product. Then they can succeed far better than they do before. We all want to make our clients look good. So therefore, it's a great, I think there's a bigger opportunity on small projects to do this on the big ones.
Yeah, I suppose it comes down to whether the commercial constraints allow that, because inevitably that it will come at a financial cost. There will be some people that say that they can't afford that option. What would you say to those people?
Well, there's a lovely Einstein quote saying, "If you do everything, if you keep on doing the same thing the same way and expect a different outcome, you're going to be very surprised or disappointed." So we know the industry is not good. We know there's far too many surprises. The only way to do it is to actually make something better. And again, I think, Steve, your analogy going back to how you buy a shirt, or actually I could have used the example of how you buy a TV, I think really, really instructive. We all buy a really dodgy TV, the first TV we buy. We all go and buy one that doesn't have a brand name from a really cheap store. It looks like it's half the price of a decent one. And we all deeply regret the decision afterwards. And usually we replace it in a very short period of time. We all buy badly on something like that. But then we learn, and we learn to actually buy from somewhere you trust in a way that you know you're going to get what you want, and it's going to actually have a whole life that's actually much better, that gives you an awful lot more utility for a lot longer. Unfortunately, I think public procurement has forgotten a lot of those lessons and actually doesn't serve the outcome it's meant to. So it doesn't produce better or cheaper things. Yes, it produces a very competitive initial cost, but not a more efficient outturn cost, and often doesn't produce a thing that was meant to do in the first place. Using your shirt analogy, I'm sure you can stretch it. I'm sure we can stretch it a long way into how things should be bought. But the critical thing we all know from buying things, and it comes back to circular economy and low carbon, is to buy something that's going to endure and to think about things properly. So therefore, we need to design the project properly from the outset to be one that isn't going to be a building that will be demolished in 30 years' time. We need to design it with a design life. And this is actually happening at the moment. So for instance, when we are asked to design a car park now, we make sure there's a second use in the structure because we know a car park in virtually every situation is going to be built in. It's not going to be used for parking cars in 20 or 30 years' time. So very few car parks, multi-story car parks, being built nowadays for very good reasons. But actually, we should think about secondary uses for things. And by doing so, by putting that little bit of extra design in at the beginning and thinking, we produce something that's much better.
We touched on HS2, obviously mega scheme. The predictions are that it will double the size of the foundation industry in the UK during its period. Indications at the moment, it's likely to really get going at the end of the year. We've had the green light. It's a fantastic opportunity to do some of the things that we talked about with procurement and the supply chain. Also going to bring a few challenges, isn't it, in terms of recruitment and bringing people through. Well, have you already started making plans and changes at Arup's? Because there must be a huge demand for your services, both in geotechnics, but also in infrastructure and structural and civils. Isn't it going to be tough to resource all that?
Not really. I mean, for us, we've been designing it for a very long period of time. So for us, we've enjoyed doing it. I should also just say I really support the HS2 project from a carbon point of view, because building a long distance electrified railway is the only way to achieve mode shift from cars and lorries to a much less polluting form of transport. So again, the outcome for the country is going to be really good. At that high level, I support the project hugely. It's also really timely. I think 2020, 2021 has been an interesting year, starting off. And I think now it's really good to have a shovel-ready project like HS2 that will enable the supply our industry to bridge over what could be quite a tricky gap. I think to an extent we were faced with the potential of it being, as you say, a huge feast. As in, how do we actually staff up to actually make sure we do this? I think it might be slightly more prosaic than that. I think it could be the thing that keeps an awful lot of people employed and going, doing interesting work for a lot longer. So as you're right, I mean, if the peak of HS2 had occurred at the peak of many other parts of the industry, as it looked like it was going to be doing, first of all, it wouldn't have been very good in many ways, because that tends to drive up prices and down standards, because actually things don't work out as well as they should do. I think at the current way, it should be actually hopefully good for both, in that the HS2 will get the attention of the best that their industry can actually put at it. And our industry will have a very useful way of keeping people employed at a time when other demand may have been drying up. And the outcome for the country is actually going to be really good, in that it gets a great outcome at the end of the day. Once those trains start going, connectivity, productivity for the national basis, I think, will be increased in the most carbon efficient way possible.
Well, I'm sold on that. I pose my question really as a provocateur, but I'm confident that the industry can deliver the people it needs. There's some really interesting schemes coming through, both operative level, but also at graduate level. The degree apprenticeship schemes that we're seeing more of and the government have supported offer a great route, I think, for people at school leaving age to come into the industry, to get on-the-job experience, to get academic qualifications just as good as a bachelor's or a master's degree, not have a mountain of debt as well. Have you seen people come through the ARUPS system with such a qualification, or is it something you're pushing out yourself?
We're lucky. I mean, in a way, our recruitment tends to be longer term. And we haven't recruited explicitly for HS2. But as you say, the current educational system is going some interesting changes. The fact that people end up with a lot of debt is unfortunate. And as you say, I think the apprentice scheme that HS2 and other really good public sector employers have been pushing, I think is transformational. And I think it's impossible. We must remember that Crossrail and other big public schemes do create an awful lot of social good in what they do. So I totally agree with you, Steve, about the benefit of apprenticeships. I think there's an awful lot to actually do for diversity as well. We work in an industry that's been very male-dominated for a very long period of time. Again, in my career, I remember, not so much in the UK, but mainly in East Asia, women were not allowed down in tunnels because they were considered unlucky. We've now come to an era where the HS2 tunnelling machines and the Crossrail tunnelling machines are actually named after famous females who had were impactful. We spoke about digital earlier on as providing producing a much more attractive industry for people to join. So I think these big public schemes are excellent for actually creating a change, but I'm not sure it's happening fast enough at an industry level otherwise. In fact, actually, I'm certain it wasn't happening often enough. And I'm looking forward to seeing an awful lot more female operatives actually out on site. I still think one of the last bastions which we need to try and tackle are plant operators and effectively labourers. I mean, why shouldn't females be out in those situations? It shouldn't depend on brawn anymore. And I think I'm looking forward to the piling industry, I think, embracing the challenge given to us by HS2 to take on more and better apprentices who can come in, as you say, by different ways, and especially to hit the EDI thing and make it into a much more equitable industry for everybody.
Well, you won't be surprised to hear that diversity, equality, it will be a subject of future podcasts, and it's a passion of mine, and I think there's a tremendous opportunity. And to go back to what we were talking about at the outset of the podcast, which was around the problems with COVID, it's also shone a light on how we can come up with more flexible working practices. So some of my crews at Central Pining, get a little plug in there, that they are they're working shorter shifts during this period where we're struggling with social distancing. So they're working 8 till 2. Why not do a couple of shorter shifts? So we're still getting the same productivity, actually probably more productivity. But we're enabling people to travel to a site, do a shift, travel back, and still see their family in the evening. Is that too much to ask? And that's going to address concerns of males. But we know that women have more difficulty with that because of the traditions of parental responsibility, and it's going to take a shift in how we do things. But I think there's a great opportunity there.
I think it's actually moving away from being the zero sort of zero profit or virtually zero profit industry that we have been, because actually everything then becomes too difficult. And if we can actually, first of all, make ourselves more profitable, must be a good thing, but actually is then be able to do the right thing by our employees. So the fact that we actually can't afford people to have a family life is a bad thing. And in a way, we need to mandate that people have a right to have a family life, male or female, parents or non-parents, whatever the actual metric is, and make sure that becomes baked into how we do things. And those costs aren't seen as a loss by an employer. They're seen as just a cost of doing business, because and having a level playing field and making sure we're not undercut by somebody else. And again, I'm switching this in a way into being probably parents and non-parents, because as you say, we need to allow that traditional change in actually how families work to come into effect. And we as Arup, we've given people male parental leave of 3 months or longer, male parental leave as well. And that's changed the paradigm fairly strongly. First of all, guys want to have more time with their family at an early stage when babies are there, but also shifts the paradigm very strongly away from any inherent bias that people might have of saying, aha, women are going to go and have babies. Families have babies, not women. Families bring up children, not just women. And until we actually shift that paradigm and make sure people think about that as an equitable thing, not as a sort of that's a female thing. I think we're getting there. But it does, we found, like I say, there was a cost hit to the company by doing it. And I wish it was mandated across the whole economy. But actually, that was the biggest single shift in what we did, in how we did things. And the benefits have been very positive in terms of employee retention and other things. Yes, there's an extra cost of doing business, but it pays for itself.
Tim, on that point, and it's a really key message, I'd like to bring the podcast to a close and thank you so much for joining us today. I'm sure that our listeners will have enjoyed it. I'll be encouraging them to send in messages and questions on LinkedIn and Twitter. So perhaps you'll keep an eye on those and be able to answer some of those questions as they arrive as well.
Delighted to see you. Thanks for the really good questions.
Thank you for listening to the FPS podcast. If you've enjoyed it, then please subscribe to us on your chosen podcast app so you never miss an episode. Also, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, then we'd really appreciate it if you could leave a written review and also a rating out of 5. If you'd like to get in touch about anything we discussed today or to suggest what kind of content you'd like to hear in the future, then please find me on LinkedIn, search for Steve Hadley. Next time, we'll be focusing on mental health and fatigue within the construction industry. Contributions from our charity partner Mates in Mind and also Fatigue Science. Thanks again for listening, and I hope you can join me next time.